If we look into it as a catastrophe, I think we right away question the type of investment we have made in the last 20 years and its effectiveness.
Trying to prevent catastrophe in Afghanistan. It's Monday, June 21st. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, escaping Afghanistan, remembering world refugees, COVID complicates Myanmar refugees, President Biden's first major trip, and an old observance becomes a new holiday. It's all on today's VOA Asia. As the United States and NATO pull their troops out of Afghanistan, civilian casualties have increased, especially among women and children. With the outlook bleak, experts are considering options to try to prevent catastrophe in the war-stricken country. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
With U.S. and NATO forces set to be out of Afghanistan this year, the future of the country is on a lot of people's minds, including U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Biden said Putin asked him about it at their summit in Geneva.
He asked us about Afghanistan. He said that he hopes that we're able to maintain some peace and security. And I said that has a lot to do with you. He indicated that he was prepared to, quote, help on Afghanistan. I won't go into detail now.
With civilian casualties almost 30% higher in Afghanistan than they were around this time last year, experts gathered remotely on Zoom for a forum held by the Center for Strategic International Studies entitled Preventing Catastrophe in Afghanistan. One of the speakers, Afghanistan's ambassador to the United Nations, Adela Raz, objected to the narrative suggested by the title.
I know we all are preparing or thinking of a worst-case scenario, but I must tell you the catastrophe is not as magnified in Afghanistan as much as it is outside of Afghanistan. And if we look into it as a catastrophe, I think we right away question the type of investment we have made in the last 20 years and its effectiveness. So there is no catastrophe. I think it's a very difficult testing period for us.
Raz said U.S. and NATO investment in her country has paid off. She said Afghan national forces are now capable and at the forefront of fighting terrorism. But she stressed they need continued logistical and financial support so that the Taliban know they can never take over the country by force.
Yesterday's class was good, was it not?
Some lawmakers, including Representative Michael Waltz of Florida, still wish Biden would leave a small contingent of U.S. troops there.
To be candid, I fear making a strategic mistake with a full withdrawal from Afghanistan. I've long supported keeping a small training capacity to continue to work with and train our Afghan national security partners and a counterterrorism capacity.
Biden says there is no military solution to the conflict in Afghanistan, but has pledged continued American support to the Afghan people. Experts say the U.S. must keep in mind how high the humanitarian and national security stakes are, and to make sure that Afghanistan does not face catastrophe after foreign forces leave. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
You'll find this and all of our other stories online by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook and the VOAnews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Thailand starts human trials of homegrown COVID-19 vaccines. At United Nations, states condemn Myanmar's junta. Court denies bail for Hong Kong pro-democracy media executives. The world observes World Refugee Day. New photography shows Cambodian refugees accomplish so much. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the VOAnews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We have more VOA Asia for you right now. In an effort to escape the insecurity and war in Afghanistan, thousands of Afghans are making a difficult journey to Turkey illegally each year. VOA's Lima Niazi brings us the story of two friends whose journey through Turkey and Europe ended back in Afghanistan. Bejan Hamdard narrates.
With hopes of one day finding refuge in Europe, thousands of young Afghans enter Turkey each year, often facing hardship and danger traveling through Iran. While the number of undocumented Afghan migrants in Turkey is currently in the hundreds of thousands, some are deported back to Afghanistan. Like Bilal Ahmed and Munir, two friends who began their journeys in southern Afghanistan.
I started my journey from Nimroz province. We were 35 people in one pickup truck, and then we walked for 48 hours. There were many difficulties.
The Afghan Ministry of Refugees and Repatriation says that since the beginning of this year, more than 9,000 have returned from Turkey and other European countries to Afghanistan, either by force or voluntarily.
I worked for 3 months but was arrested and deported by the Turkish police. I paid so much money to smugglers, and all that was for nothing.
Ahmed and Munir say their futures in Afghanistan look bleak, with so many young people like them fleeing the country due to unemployment, poverty, and insecurity.
I will try to go there again to reach Europe. I have an elderly father and he cannot work. We are in difficult economic situations, so I must send money by working there.
According to the country's Directorate of Migration Statistics, more than 450,000 migrants entered Turkey illegally in 2019, a huge increase from 2013. Both Ahmed and Munir say they will try again to reach Turkey. For Lima Niazi in Kabul, Afghanistan, Bejan Hamdat, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, Taiwan said 11 employees of its trade office in Hong Kong left the financial hub after authorities there demanded they sign a pledge recognizing China's sovereignty over the self-ruled island. The move comes after both Hong Kong and Macau closed their trade offices in Taipei. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're starting off a brand new week together on VOA Asia. The United Nations reports that by the end of 2020, the number of people around the world who had been forcibly displaced from their homes totaled 82.4 million. That's the highest number on record. VOA's Laurel Bowman has more on the United Nations annual report as we observed World Refugee Day Sunday.
I'm very happy to see you.
The smiles, the songs, the prayers, the kicks.
Playing soccer makes me feel really, really happy and really social.
These are some of the 82.4 million people the UN reports has displaced in 2020 by persecution, human rights violations, and events seriously disturbing public order. It's the highest number on record and comes even with COVID-19 restrictions on movement and border closures.
And what is really quite shocking is that over the last 10 years, the numbers of people who are refugees or forcibly displaced has more than doubled. Something like 48% are children and youths. So we really have generations of children who are separated from their countries of origin.
The UN reports that overall, 1 in 95 people is now forcibly displaced, including more than half the population of Syria, both inside the country and out. Syrians represent the largest group of those displaced internationally, and experts say their needs are many.
I want to tell you about even education. You cannot just put education alone. You need to put education with mental health, for instance, together, because we have a lot of traumatized Syrian refugees and they cannot comprehend. So you need to work on the mental health, like psychosocial support, plus education.
Venezuelans represent the second largest group of forcibly displaced people. Many have fled to neighboring Colombia. And displacement from Central America is up 50-fold over the last 10 years, with many refugees heading north to the United States.
And I think it's really important to think about refugees not just as a burden on society, but to think about them as consumers and contributors, because they actually add to economic growth. They add to economic development.
The number of unaccompanied children in 2020 was disproportionately high, according to the UN report, and climate change further drove migration and increased instability among those already on the move.
The need for resources, water, land, ability to feed herds and to grow crops, these are all affected by climate change, and they lead to conflict. And conflict leads to displacement.
The UN report showed that 86% of people displaced across borders are hosted by developing countries. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. The United States is sending 2.5 million COVID-19 vaccines to Taiwan, substantially increasing its initial promise of 750,000 doses. Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen said the increased doses from the United States are a moving gesture of friendship. You'll find this and all the big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, on World Refugee Day, Rohingya people living in Bangladesh say COVID and conflict have added to their miseries, leaving them with little to look forward to. We hear more from Reuters correspondent David Doyle.
Jamaleda says she and other members of the Rohingya community wanted to celebrate World Refugee Day on Sunday, but they can't. The refugee camps where they live are under lockdown. It's just another reason why people who live here, having fled brutality in their home country, Myanmar, have little to look forward to. We want to go back to our country, she says. How can we go back? The Rohingya are a Muslim minority group, most of whom were denied citizenship in Buddhist-majority Myanmar, even though some can trace their roots in the country back centuries. Nearly 1 million live here in Cox's Bazar, having fled a military crackdown in Rakhine State, which borders Bangladesh, nearly 4 years ago. It's the world's largest refugee settlement. But for Shakufa Begum, it is a graveyard.
Our life is finished. Our life is dead. Now we are not thinking about ourselves, just thinking about our future generations very much. I have two daughters and a son. My first baby was 4 years old when I came to Bangladesh. As yet, there is no chance of an education for her. Why can't my children go to school? What will their future be? What about other Rohingya children in the camps here?
Many Rohingya say the global health crisis has diminished international concern over their situation. Bangladesh is keen to see them return to Myanmar, but following a military coup in February, there has been little sign of progress in talks with Myanmar's junta. That leaves Rohingya refugees with little certainty over their future and little cause to celebrate on World Refugee Day.
Reuters correspondent David Doyle. Making headlines in Asia, Australia is asking the World Trade Organization to intervene in its dispute with China over the imposition of anti-dumping duties on Asian wine exports. Relations between Australia and China, its biggest trading partner, are at their worst in decades, with diplomatic friction over regional geopolitical flashpoints. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, President Joe Biden wrapped up a very busy week of summits in Europe last week as the United States reclaimed a leadership role among its democratic allies. We hear more from VOA's Mike O'Sullivan.
A productive meeting with allies, Biden said after a NATO summit, with America back at the table, he said after the meeting of the G7 industrial nations. Reaching agreements in a separate summit with Russia's Vladimir Putin for future talks on arms control and cybersecurity. Biden accomplished his main goal, says one analyst, to strengthen the transatlantic alliance to address challenges.
From COVID to technology to regulation to security issues to managing the rising threat of China and Russia. You know, I think the administration set out on some pretty broad objectives, first and foremost, to repair the damage that was wrought by the previous administration. I think they achieved that.
Biden reasserting partnerships and dealing with adversaries.
He certainly restored a workmanlike spirit to the alliance and had a good NATO summit. He certainly had a realistic summit with Vladimir Putin.
On the table in the discussions, Russian aggression against its neighbors and the plight of Putin critic Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader in a Russian prison. The U.S. and its allies want to engage with Russia, says analyst Simakovsky, where it is possible.
But also highlighting that additional Russian aggression is going to spur costs from the United States and from the NATO alliance. And President Biden was very clear that both on cyber, on destabilizing Russian actions in Ukraine, on potentially the opposition in Russia, Navalny, if he dies in prison, unfortunately, those will all raise a U.S. response.
The G7 criticized China for human rights abuses and Russia for cyber attacks and the use of chemical weapons. Biden said Russia and China will not succeed in dividing the allies. O'Hanlon says the allies wrestled with difficult trade issues, ending a long standoff over aircraft subsidies. But he adds more progress is needed.
The disagreements are still there, and there are a number that Biden could not or did not solve on this trip, including travel in the time of COVID. That's one outstanding issue where we haven't yet reached agreement. There are some other specific trade matters where there's still debates over subsidies and openness and fairness.
The G7 pledged more action on climate change, though not enough to satisfy critics, and promised 1 billion doses of COVID vaccines to lower-income countries. The analysts agree that for Biden, the trip was productive.
For the first trip as U.S. president, it's going to be historically seen as a good starting point for his foreign policy ambitions.
Missing from the talks, says analyst O'Hanlon, were broader discussions on the future of NATO, which has grown from 12 to 30 members. But he adds the meetings did reflect a growing consensus on dealing with a belligerent Russia and a rising challenger, China. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
Also late last week, U.S. President Joe Biden signed into law the creation of a new federal holiday commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. It becomes the 11th U.S. federal holiday, as VOA's Mariama Diallo has more.
Across America, people have celebrated Juneteenth or Freedom Day every year since June 19, 1865. Kelly Elaine Navies is a museum specialist and oral historian at the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington.
Well, on June 19, 1865, General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, with a force of 1,800 Union troops, many of whom were actually United States colored troops, and announced General Order 3, stating that the enslaved were now free. This was important because although the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed on January 1st, 1863, that really only impacted states in the Confederacy and then only states where there was a Union presence.
Navies says that when she was a child, her father, who was an educator, made it a tradition to celebrate Juneteenth.
He would invite not just his students at Berkeley High School, but he would also invite his friends and family and members of the community, barbecuing all hours of the night. From a young age, my job was to chop onions and potatoes. And we would have a program that was intergenerational. Children would perform and read poetry. create dances, an open mic. Elders would speak and share stories of their experiences with being Black in America.
Juneteenth has been a state holiday in nearly all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Last year, in the wake of millions demonstrating against racial injustice after the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others, a bipartisan group tried to get Congress to recognize Juneteenth as a federal holiday. On Thursday, after more than 150 years, Juneteenth was established as the newest federal holiday at a White House ceremony after a bill passed earlier this week by Congress.
It's a celebration of the emancipation of African Americans who were enslaved, but it's also a day of remembrance. So I'm eager to see not only the Juneteenth holiday be recognized by the federal government, but I'm eager to see how it is recognized, how it is celebrated, how it is used as a tool of education for people, and how it can ultimately bring us more in line with what the hope of emancipation was, which is freedom for everybody. I think it can be a positive development for good for all of us.
But Justin Hansford, law professor at Howard University, also noted the dichotomy between what happened in Washington on Tuesday and current events in the state of Texas.
On the same day that Juneteenth was passed in the Senate, the state of Texas, where Juneteenth originates from, passed a law banning the teaching of the 1619 Project, banning critical race theory, banning the opportunity to teach about Black history. So it's almost like a joke where you pass a proclamation recognizing an important moment in Black history. And at the same time, on the same day, the state where that particular incident took place is passing a law banning the teaching of Black history.
HB 3979 is sponsored by Texas State Representative Steve Toth, who said in an interview with the National Review, "The facts are very clear, very explicit. We don't ban, we don't discourage the discussion of anything." But Hansford says it's important to understand there is a connection between Juneteenth and the banning of certain teachings.
Don't forget that the Juneteenth story is a story about Black people who were free, but the knowledge of their freedom, the awareness of their freedom, was denied to them. And here at the same time, we see that same denial of access to information and the denial of access to knowledge being written into law in the state of Texas, the state of Florida, and other states that are passing these anti-critical race theory laws.
Critical race theory, according to Hansford, is a field of study that seeks to uncover the way that race played a central role in how American society is structured. While debated by academics since the 1970s, it has only recently become a political issue.
This is a deliberate plan to politicize and whitewash history.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Stop it.
Last week, Florida's Board of Education banned the theory from its public schools.
I think it'll cause people to think of themselves more as a member of a particular race or based on skin color, rather than based on the content of their character.
And in Leesburg, Virginia last weekend, a rally against critical race theory teachings. Activist Patty Manders opposes anti-racism teaching that she believes trains white children to see themselves as oppressors. But while school curriculum is a lightning rod for controversy, a Juneteenth federal holiday has become law.
The bill is passed.
Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
That's our program for today. Thanks for joining us on VOA Asia. Continue online. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and find us on Instagram and YouTube. We also thank our team, Service Chief Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.